It's been about 6 months. It's great to see all of you. Quite the last couple of days, huh? Been doing lots of metta practice and compassion practice for the people in Ukraine. Hopefully some of you have been taking advantage of your practice time to do some of that as well. Of course, it's been making me contemplate what exactly is a wise person. There certainly is a lot of unwise decision-making and behavior in the world these days. Makes me wonder, what is a wise person? In my usual way, I started to look around at the suttas, and weirdly enough, I happened to open the Dhammapada, a collection of sayings of the Buddha, in verse form. And it's nice that it's in verse form because it's very pithy, very succinct, easy to understand. And of course, it's one of the most widely read and best known collection of the Buddhist scriptures. Even the Buddhist scholar and commentator Buddhaghosa claimed that each saying recorded in the collection was made on a different occasion in response to a unique situation that had arisen in the life of the Buddha and the monastic community. The Dhammapada is full of lots of good advice about how to practice the Dharma. I happened to open the Dhammapada and I came upon verse 6 and 7. And verse 6 is actually called the Wise One. And it is a lovely, pithy description of what makes a person wise, just so that you would recognize a wise person if they showed up in your life. And if they did, what you should do when they show up in your life. So I thought that I would read verse 6 to you, and we could talk about it a little bit. I also have verse 7, the arhat, or the awakened person. I liked the distinction between what makes a wise person and what makes an awakened person. Verse 6, the wise one, begins thusly. The wise one tells you where you have fallen and where you yet may fall. And this is invaluable information. This is the very first description of a wise one. They tell you when you've lost your way, and they even have the ability to predict how you may lose your way in the future. That is someone I definitely would like to know. Maybe some of you would like to know someone like that too. And yes, it's invaluable information, particularly when you live with other people in spiritual community. The verse continues. Follow the wise one and follow the way. Let the wise one chasten and teach you and keep you from mischief. The world may hate the wise ones, but good people love them. And this is so interesting. Allegedly, historical records of the Buddha having a lot of trouble in some of the places in which he resided over the 40 years that he taught. He was a prince. And even though he gave up all of that, kingdoms have relationships. So there were some places where the Sangha went where the relations weren't so good. The Buddha was surrounded by pundits from the Hindu tradition and some of the other spiritual traditions that existed at the time. Sometimes when he resided in places with the Sangha, he was misunderstood quite a bit. You know, some of the other people in the other traditions felt threatened. When a person is wise, they are often saying things that can make people uncomfortable because they're telling the truth or because they're pointing to things about humans that make us uncomfortable. Often these people are not well-liked, although even though they're not well-liked, the Buddha entreats us to remember good people will recognize wise people and they will appreciate the things that they teach even when the teaching is difficult to digest. Do not look for bad company or live with those who are uncaring. Find friends who love the truth. This is the teaching about the Sangha. This particular line is telling us how to cultivate wisdom by surrounding ourselves with others who are similarly interested in wisdom and compassion and are not bad actors in the world or in their relationships. Drink deeply. Live in serenity and joy. The wise one delights in the truth, delights in the Dhamma. For the Buddha, living in truth means working the teachings and recognizing when the mind is lost, when we've lost awareness, when we are not mindful, when we're not skillful, when we're not perceiving ourselves and our world correctly with truth in our hearts and our minds. The farmer channels water to the land, the fletcher whittles arrows, and the carpenter turns wood. So the wise one skillfully directs mind. This allows us to recognize when we meet someone who's wise, chances are they're going to be someone who's supremely interested in taming the mind, behaving appropriately, behaving wisely, acting from a level of presence and clarity, not just in mind, but perceptual clarity, able to see the world clearly, able to see one's own intention clearly. There's a beautiful metaphor in the Tibetan tradition of the rider and the horse. The rider is the mind, and the horse is the rest of the organism. If the rider is being led by the horse, there's very little chance for wisdom. So training the mind is the ultimate skill that a wise person uses. The wind cannot shake a mountain. Neither praise nor blame moves the wise one. The wise one is clarity, hearing the truth. They are like a lake, pure and tranquil and deep. So these two lines go together, that unshakability of mind, the unshakability of ego orientation, the lack of fixation on wants. This is a critical part of wisdom, and all that arises from clarity. In the Buddhist path, it is through hearing the teachings that we recognize what clarity is. And through the practices we are offered in the Buddhist teachings, we're able to cultivate that clarity in real time, whether we are practicing on the cushion or whether we are practicing off the cushion, in every moment. And that is why the wise one, hearing the Dhamma, is like a pure, tranquil, and deep lake. This is the nature of mind, always. It is a pure, tranquil, and deep lake. And the clarity is the lack of obscuration. It's the lack of the things we bring to our experience that get in the way of us experiencing the purity, the tranquility, and the depth of awareness. Want nothing. When there is desire, say nothing. Whatever befalls you, walk on, untouched, unattached. I really like this particular line because for me, I think this is where many people get tripped up with the Buddhist teachings. It's very difficult to live in a human body and want nothing. We have to eat to live, and we have to make sure we have water to live. Humans require a dwelling, a place where they can rest, because we require sleep. These are things that we want, and these kinds of wants get tied up and bound up with all kinds of ideas we have about what's required to fulfill these particular basic human needs. And besides food and shelter, you know, humans are tribal animals. We need each other. We need community. We need connection. I continually ask myself, I live in a human body. How can I possibly want nothing? And this line says, where there is desire, say nothing. Well, if I don't say anything, it's going to be hard for me to communicate my needs in such a way that I can connect with others in order to satisfy my basic human needs. You know, this is, for me, one of the places where the Buddhist teachings appear to be counter to a basic human existence. The thing is, wanting nothing and recognizing the true nature of desire from the point of view of wisdom doesn't have to do with basic human needs in and of themselves. It has to do with our concepts about them and the way we ideate for ourselves that contentment cannot exist when there is not a specific way in which these basic human needs get met. And if you really think deeply on this, you can see how when the Buddha talked about the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion, if you really think about greed, hatred, and delusion, all three of these qualities will taint and distort any desire for basic sustenance. So the question becomes, how does one walk in one's life untouched and unattached? How do you do this? I think it's similar in a way to many years ago, I studied with Brooke Medicine Eagle. This was in my mid-20s. At the time, I had heard the phrase walking in beauty, but I didn't understand what it meant. And I remember asking Brooke Medicine Eagle, what does this mean, walking in beauty? I don't understand. And what she told me was something that I later heard Dzogchen Rinpoche say to me almost 30 years later. She said, if you walk lightly in your life, you will touch many, but you won't soil anything. And I really had to think about that and feel into what that meant, because at the time, I was not living a kind of life where I was walking lightly. I had a very hard step, and I wanted to be seen, and I needed to be seen, and I had been trained to be noticed and to be seen and to get famous in the arts. This was my path. Even though I was a practitioner, still, this was my conditioning. And here it is in the Buddhist teachings, walking lightly. So the Buddha continues, do not ask for family, power, or wealth, either for yourself or for another. A wise one has no wish to rise unjustly. Few cross over the river. Most are stranded on this side of the river. On the riverbank, they run up and down. But the wise one, following the way, crosses over beyond the reach of death. The wise one leaves the dark path for the way of light. Leaving home, the wise one seeks contentment on the hard road, free from desire, free from possessions, appetite, grasping, free from the dark places of the heart. Following the seven lights of awakening and rejoicing greatly in freedom, in this world, the wise one becomes a light in a world of darkness, pure, shining, and free. The verse ends by describing walking lightly, walking untouched, undesired, unattached, no matter what may befall us. There is that sense of crossing over beyond, it says, the reach of death. For me, what that means is beyond the reach of the fear of loss, because the wise one seeks contentment on the way and doesn't grasp or cling to where they've been, freed from desire, grasping, following the seven lights of awakening, and rejoicing in freedom. So that is Dhammapada, verse 6, the wise one. Dhammapada, verse 7, is called the Arhat, or the perfected one. Here the Buddha is certainly making the distinction. You can be wise, you can be a good practitioner. That does not mean you are an arahat or a perfected one. That is the bad news. So in verse 7, the Buddha describes the arahat, and it begins thusly. At the end of the way, the awakened one finds freedom from desire and sorrow, freedom without bounds, gain and loss, praise and blame, wanting, losing. At the end of the way, the awakened one is free from all clinging, unbounded freedom. Those who awaken do not stay in one place. Like swans, they rise and leave the lake. On the air, they rise and fly an invisible course, gathering nothing, storing nothing. Their food is knowledge. They live upon emptiness. They have seen how to break free. So who can follow them? Isn't this so beautiful? This is actually Thomas Byron's translation. I don't usually use translations other than Bhikkhu Bodhi, but this is a very old translation from a scholar. It's beautiful, and the feeling of this translation is very lovely for me. On the air, the awakened one flies an invisible course. It's hard to see where an awakened one goes because they gather nothing and they store nothing. They leave no residue. That's the thing. Leaving no residue. That is the clarity of mind that the Buddha is pointing at. When there is no soilness, this is what Brooke was trying to tell me. When there's no residue, one can go from place to place, transparent. In the transparency, this is obviously from the Mahayana teachings on emptiness, Prajnaparamita, the utter transparency of clarity and emptiness of mind brought into the embodied existence through this invisibility of residue. Who can follow such an awakened one? And it continues. Only the awakened one, like a bird, rises on the limitless air and flies an invisible course, wishing for nothing. When food is knowledge, one lives in emptiness. The inter-aring, which is Thich Nhat Hanh's term for emptiness, the utter inter-aring of all phenomena simultaneously arising, existing, and passing away, including the arhat, the one who walks in the world without residue. The awakened one has broken free and is the charioteer. Having tamed the six senses, and remember in Buddhism, the functional mind is the sixth sense. Five sensory senses and then the functional mind. Having tamed the six senses and gone beyond greed, hatred, and delusion, even the gods admire the awakened one. Yielding like the earth, joyous and clear like the lake. Still as the stone at the door, the awakened one is free from life and death. Yielding like the earth is such an interesting phrase. You know, the earth is so solid, we don't really think of the earth as yielding, but we have acted on our earth so intensely, and it has yielded so much to our insatiability, and we have destroyed so much. We have hardly walked on earth without residue, and yet the Buddha's experience of earth is the beauty of the way our planet yields to us, its children. Yielding like the earth, joyous and clear like the lake, still as the stone at the door. So this is the ultimate description of an awakened mind. Yielding, completely flexible, no rigidity whatsoever. Joyous, clear, still. And when the mind is imbued with these qualities, this is freedom from life and death. The mind is still, speech is still, work is stillness. The awakened one knows freedom. Stillness pervading, whether there's doing or not doing. I know Donald Rothberg will be sharing so much of his beautiful teaching on doing and not doing in the day long, and I encourage you all to attend that because you'll have a taste. Mind is still, speech is still, work is stillness. Movement and stillness, simultaneous. The awakened one knows freedom. The awakened one renounces all views, seeing beyond the end and the beginning. Seeing beyond the arising, existing and passing away of all phenomena, your thoughts, your feelings, this world, everything, your body, seeing beyond the end and the beginning of all existent phenomena, the awakened one renounces all views of existence and rests in the clear, unbounded, awakened clarity of mind. And this is the difference between the wise one and the awakened one. This gone beyond. Gate, gate, padasam gate, bodhi swaha. This is from the Heart Sutra. Beyond, beyond the beyond. This is the truth. So that is the end of verse 7. And maybe you can get a sense of why when I went to these two passages in the Dhammapada, I felt so inspired, particularly with so much disturbance happening in the world. It was such a cleansing for me personally to read the teachings on walking lightly in the world, being a light in the world of darkness, living in an existence where work is suffused with stillness, with freedom, with clarity, which is something I think we all have a responsibility to offer the world right now when there's so much disturbance. I hope this was enjoyable for all of you. I'm happy to hear anything any of you might want to share or ask questions or anything about this incredibly beautiful teachings of the Buddha.
Thank you. Can you summarize part about who can follow the awakened one? The question, who can follow such a person?
When it says who can follow,
what does that mean?
I don't think it means who can be a devotee. It's when the movement is so thoroughly transparent, when a person is not leaving behind a trail of ego fixation and trouble, like the way Putin is leaving it behind right now. You know, it's pretty easy to follow him, right? But when someone is walking in the world in such a way where they're not creating disturbance and where the movement itself is so reflective of the interconnectivity of all phenomena, this is a level of recognition and understanding about the nature of how all things work that it is very difficult for us to, I think, imagine what the mind of an awakened one is actually like.
So it's more like who can follow and be like them.
That's exactly right. I hate to bring this up again, but I felt this way talking to Brooke. I was in the presence of someone who was born and raised in a tradition that was so different than the tradition I was born and raised in. And I could just concretely feel that she had a way of walking on this earth that my conditioning prevented me from experiencing directly. And it was very sad for me. And she really was just such an incredible teacher because she insisted that I not be brokenhearted about this, that I recognize, even though I would never be able to directly experience the way she connected with this world, that if I was pure in my heart and I continued to be interested in, she was actually a Lakota, in the Lakota teachings, that there would be something that I would derive from it.
I just want to say thank you. I found that very soothing and very calming. I have no fantasies about being an arahat, but always try to cultivate a little wisdom.
You're very welcome. And I really want to encourage all of you. We know how it really is a part of being a Buddhist practitioner to just keep practicing. However, I really want you all to know awakening is your birthright. You are in a human body to awaken, and you can awaken in any moment. So it is not a fantasy. And I don't want any of you to think it's a fantasy. Well, it's good to see you all again. Second week of war, too. So I guess I thought I might stay on the theme. Largely because, you know, the Buddha taught so much about nonviolence, about the alleviation of suffering. I thought it was good to stay on topic. So I thought I would start with a couple of quotes from the Dalai Lama, who in his young life saw quite a bit of war before he escaped and went over the Himalayas into Dharamsala. So two quotes from the Dalai Lama. The first one is short and succinct. War is out of date, obsolete. And I couldn't agree more. And then the second quote, in olden times, when there was a war, it was a human-to-human confrontation. The victor in battle would directly see the blood and suffering of the defeated enemy. Nowadays, it is much more terrifying because a person in an office can push a button and kill millions of people and never see the human tragedy that he or she has created. The mechanization of war, the mechanization of human conflict, poses an increasing threat to peace. It is one of the big problems with war these days, that it can be conducted at a distance without any contact at all with what is actually happening on the ground. And then I thought I would read an email that came into my inbox today from Mindy Rinpoche, who is currently residing at Osaling, which is the monastery that he has in Nepal. And I won't read the whole thing. He said, I have many students both in Ukraine and Russia, and I know they are in great distress. This anguish is reverberating across the world. In response to all this suffering, we at Osaling are holding daily pujas, praying for a swift resolution of this conflict and world peace. We pray for both Ukrainian and Russian people and for all of Europe and the world. As we open our hearts to this suffering, we must do so with great compassion and wisdom, recalling our fundamental basic goodness, interdependence, and interconnection. Each part of the world, like parts of the human body, must work in harmony in order to create a lasting peace. Wisdom tells us to set aside all thoughts of separateness, all forms of polarization, and come together in love and compassion to support one another in prayer, meditation, and in whatever individual or collective actions are possible to bring an end to this conflict. I ask that you do so with hearts wide open, not turning away from this suffering. So, following my dear teacher, Mindy Rinpoche, I will not turn away from the suffering. I will teach on what the historical Buddha called the rod of violence. So some of you may have heard this term before, or you may have heard the Atadanda Sutta, which is translated as the rod embraced. I thought that I would actually teach on this sutta tonight. The Buddha said that the rod of violence takes three forms: physical violence through bodily misconduct, verbal violence through verbal misconduct, and mental violence through mental misconduct. So these three forms of misconduct, bodily, verbal, and mental, make up the rod of violence. He mentions the rod of violence in several suttas, but there's one sutta about what happens when the rod of violence is embraced. And it's called the Atadanda Sutta. It's Samyutta Nikaya 4:15. I like this sutta because the Buddha appears very human in this sutta, at least at the beginning, and then he gets into his inimitable Buddha-ness toward the end. But you'll really feel the sense of this man and the life he led and his human feelings and perceptions in this sutta, which frankly is kind of rare. So here we go. The Blessed One said, "When embraced, the rod of violence breeds danger and fear. Look at people in strife. I will tell you how I have experienced terror." Remember, this is the Buddha talking. "I will tell you how I have experienced terror. Seeing people floundering like fish in small puddles, competing with one another. As I saw this, fear came into me. The world was entirely without substance. As the fear came into me, all the directions were knocked out of line." Sounds very human, doesn't it? "Wanting a haven for myself, I saw nothing that was laid claim to. Seeing nothing in the end but competition, I felt discontented. And then I saw an arrow embedded in the heart, an arrow so very hard to see. Overcome by this arrow, humans run in all directions. But simply on pulling out the arrow, you don't run, you don't sink. Whatever things are tied down in the world, you shouldn't be set on them. Having totally penetrated sensual pleasures, sensual passions, you should train for your own unbinding. Be truthful, not insolent, not deceptive. Be remote from divisiveness. Without anger, the sage can cross over the evil of greed and hatred. When you have your heart set on unbinding, on conquering drowsiness, weariness, and sloth, don't get lost in heedlessness or stand firm in your pride. Don't engage in lying or grasp at form. Fully fathom your conceit and live refraining from impulsiveness. Don't delight in what's old and prefer what's new. Grieving over decline, getting tangled in what's dazzling and bright. I call greed a great flood, hunger a swift current. Preoccupations are ripples. Sensuality is a bog hard to cross over. Not deviating from truth, the sage stands on high ground. Having relinquished in every way, he is said to be at peace. Having clearly known, a sage attains knowledge. Knowing the Dhamma brings independence. Moving rightly through the world, the sage doesn't envy anyone. For she has gone beyond sensual passions, an attachment hard to transcend in this world. The sage doesn't fret or sorrow. Habitual suffering cut, you are free from bonds. So burn up what's before and have nothing for after. If you don't grasp at what's in between, you will go about your life calm. For whom, in name and form, in every way, there's no sense of mine, and who doesn't grieve over what is not, undefeated, that sage suffers no loss. And this is mine, does not arise in mind and heart. Feeling no sense of mineness, the thought of having nothing isn't harsh, not greedy, unperturbed. Everywhere is concordance. This is the reward, I say when asked, for those who are free from theorizing, for one unperturbed, who knows there's no accumulating. Everywhere is security. The sage doesn't speak of himself as among those who are higher, equal, or lower. At peace, free of stinginess, he neither embraces nor rejects. Quite a sutta, don't you think? I mean, there's so much there. So before I expound a little bit, I just want to open it up and see if anyone has anything they'd like to share just from hearing this absolutely incredible. It's sort of like a revelation, the Buddha talking about the things he's experienced and then what liberation does and how it frees you.
I was intrigued by the line, fully fathom your conceit.
You were intrigued because it was something you hadn't heard before?
Not in that specific way. I've certainly heard about conceit and this being one of the, you know, 10 fetters and all, but to sort of fully fathom your conceit made me realize that I'm not totally clear all the time on what conceit really is. I think if it was, I'd fully fathom it.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many things here that drew me in. It's quite amazing. Okay, I will say something about that. Anybody else?
I wrote down, everywhere is security.
Yes.
That was very comforting.
That particular line, everywhere is security, actually is a result of the two things the Buddha said prior to that, which is when one is unperturbed, because they know there's no such thing as accumulating, everywhere is security. And actually, I too, when I read that line, I was thinking, there be no reason to wage war if a person realized that one line in particular. The Buddha had an interesting experience in some of the places where he went. He was not greeted well. So he did experience violence around him. The sutta begins with his description of what happened when he experienced the kind of actions that the rod of violence breeds. I was so surprised that he used the word terror. I think there's a way in which the people imagine who the Buddha was and how he was, that the feeling of terror is something he would never experience. There's no history here, so he's not saying, well, in the 6 years in which I wandered around in the forest doing ascetic practices, I experienced things that caused me to feel terror. He's not saying prior to my sitting down under the Bodhi tree. But you know, this sutta makes a really good case for the idea that the Buddha, when he sat down under the Bodhi tree, that he fully awakened to how the mind creates suffering and was free, was liberated from being caught in mental suffering ever again. That doesn't necessarily mean that if he came upon war and violence that he wouldn't experience terror. But it's super interesting because he insinuates in the next line that his terror arose from the way the people who were engaged in the violence and the victims of the violence were floundering around like fish in small puddles, competing with each other. And he says that this floundering and competition, that is what brought the fear into his heart. And I think we could pretty much all agree that there would be no reason to go into another country and wreak havoc unless you were floundering around in your own mind and you were lost in many of the things that the Buddha has pointed to later in the sutta. One of the things besides conceit, although conceit does give rise to this, is that mindness, the me and mine. And he really pointed at that in this sutta. So the competing, the competition has at its core both conceit as well as a sense of me and mine. I own this. This is mine. And the conceit, this me and mine, is such a state of attachment. And attachment meaning the self is viewing itself as the thing. It's really super interesting. It's almost as though when you're doing me and mine, you're objectifying yourself. You're not even the subject anymore. You are an object to yourself. That object is mine, and I, as an object, view myself as that. It's weird because it's a certain kind of interdependence, right? But it is not the interdependence that Buddhists talk about when we talk about emptiness. Emptiness is the recognition of the inherent inseparability of all phenomena, including the internal phenomena of this thing we think is a self. And the empty aspect of all of that is nothing exists on its own, independently of anything else. So when there's the conceit, when there's the mindness, which you have to have if you're engaged in competition, this is what scared the Buddha. The objectification, the way people objectify themselves, the way they objectify others. You can see how clearly doing violence to another human is a completely separate act. There is no sense of interconnectedness. And that's the floundering. I love this part where the Buddha said he wanted a haven for himself. Somewhere safe. Somewhere safe from the floundering and the competition that was bringing fear in him. But he saw that there was nothing. There was nowhere he could grasp onto. Nothing he could lay claim to for that haven. Because all around him was nothing but competition and the floundering. And that's when he said, I felt discontented. Wow, this is the Buddha. This is someone who has awakened to the nature of all things. And yet he's admitting discontentment. So apparently the ubiquitousness of unsatisfactoriness, it can even be experienced by a Buddha. Then there's this very cryptic, interesting part about an arrow. In the midst of his discontentment, he has an insight. He sees an arrow embedded in the heart and admits this is an arrow that's very hard to see. It's hard to see because then, he says, the arrow itself overcomes our capacity to feel from the heart. And because of this arrow that's penetrating the heart and preventing our ability to really feel the full-on compassion that we are capable of. Humans basically run in all directions, he says. And then he says, you can't just simply pull out the arrow. And that's the point at which he begins to dive into the teachings. So the arrow is very interesting. He didn't expound on this arrow embedded in the heart, but I found this particular two lines very confusing and spent quite a bit of time with them. And all I could come up with about this arrow embedded in the heart is the arrow essentially represents obstacles we have to experiencing what the Buddha taught, which was non-referential compassion. Non-referential compassion is extremely important in the Buddhist teachings. Referential compassion is what humans have very naturally, because we're tribal animals. We have the ability to care for the people in our tribe, our close relatives, the people who are our friends, the people we connect to, the people who are like us. This is something that's baked in for us. And this is referential compassion. We offer love and care to those we love and care for. The Buddha, on the other hand, was teaching non-referential compassion, which means there are no in-group and out-group. Every sentient being is equally deserving of our love and care and compassion. So the arrow embedded in the heart, which is hard to see, is when we don't regard all beings as equally deserving of our care and our respect. For me, this is the core of what creates the rod of violence. It underscores the physical, verbal, and mental violence that humans do to each other. Our inability to non-referentially love. It also undermines our ability to recognize safety wherever we are. So the Buddha launches into the teachings, and he very quickly uses a word I love, which is unbinding. He says, you should train for your own unbinding. So for me, the unbinding is the delusion of a solid separate self and also the delusion of referential compassion. Some people are deserving of my love and care and some are not. And for me, these are the two arrows that penetrate the heart and make it almost impossible to not be lost in the rod of violence, even in our daily lives. The rest of this sutta is for me, and I encourage you all to read this sutta yourselves, because this particular sutta is like the cliff notes of the Buddha's teachings. Being truthful, not deceptive, unbinding by conquering drowsiness and weariness and sloth, and of course, not getting lost in heedlessness, vigilant mindfulness, not standing in pride. And then he says, don't engage in lying or grasp at form, fully fathom conceit, and live refraining from impulsiveness. You know, I love this two lines, not just because of the fully fathomed conceit, which I agree is amazing. But what he's saying here, don't engage in lying or grasping at form. So for me, the great lie is the delusion that form is something to grasp at, that anything is something to grasp at. And the conceit is the delusion itself. We get lost in the delusion of separateness, and we're impulsive. Through our conceit, we grasp and we push away. This is our impulsiveness. At the end of the sutta, the Buddha says that the sage has one thing that trumps all other things, which is the sage experiences no sense of mindness, doesn't even have the thought of it. And that unperturbedness, that is the thing that causes a sage to be concordant no matter where the sage is, because there's no grasping at me and mine. And the Buddha says this is the reward, for everywhere is security. And that security, it's an interesting word. Maybe it's more like everywhere is home rather than everywhere is security. Everywhere is home. A mind that is fully realized, the utter selflessness of emptiness, and a heart that is imbued fully with non-referential compassion, everywhere is home, no matter where we are. So anything else?
The non-referential compassion, the unconditional love, that is hard. I don't know that I have really done that. Maybe there's been a little drop of it. If there is, I'll take that as a blessing. But see, it's just really incredible how much the Russians deserve it less. So-and-so deserves it less. These people in the political party here in the U.S. deserve it less. These people in that state in the U.S. deserve it less. Wow. I mean, it just feels like that is such a humongous task and duty of the practice.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with you. On the other hand, there are ways to practice non-referential compassion on the way to the full-on totality of non-referential compassion. Like everything else in the Buddhist teachings, there are ways to practice. This is how I do it. If I am in the midst of my own preference, which I am in the midst of a lot, I try to recognize there is a certain basic level of goodness that all beings possess, regardless of how they behave, regardless of what they do in the world. And it's my job as a Buddhist practitioner to do my best to recognize that at their core, the essence of who they are is that goodness. And the essence of who I am is also that goodness. And they and I both equally participate in the ubiquitousness of human suffering in all the ways that it arises in all of its myriad forms with humans. So we actually have something in common. For instance, Vladimir Putin, at his essence, he has goodness because that is his nature. He's not recognizing that goodness, I don't think, but he has it. Like me, he also has suffering arise in his mind. So because we are both human and because we both have that, there is no reason for me to generate hatred toward him. There is no reason for me to accept what he does as right. It's my job to stand in the ethical knowing that I have about what human conduct that creates non-suffering is. And it's my job to practice that because I am a practitioner, and then to do, yeah, depending on whatever you wish, whichever of the myriad compassion practices you wish to do, whether it's doing metta, to see him freed from his suffering and not causing harm to other humans. This is our job as practitioners. And that is the practice of non-referential compassion. It's faking it till you make it.
Yeah. Or like approximating it more or something, getting closer and closer to it, you know?
It was great because in this sutta, the Buddha actually says you have to give up your concept. My concept of non-referential compassion, I need to give up. What I need to do instead is embrace the recognition that at my core, there is goodness, and every single human being has that also. And my mind suffers, and all humans have their brand of suffering. And every single human is capable of being liberated from suffering through their own effort. We can all awaken. That is non-referential compassion as a practitioner. Does that help? You really can't look at all this stuff as I've got to be a Buddha today. Because what will happen is you will lack faith You will lack resolve. You will lack diligence. You will lack all the things the Buddha keeps telling us we need to have. I hope this was helpful tonight. I'm sorry that we don't have more time.